Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the launch of this marvellous volume. Does it sound not very good? The new egalitarianism. This is, in effect, the second launch of the book because we launched it, first of all, about 3 weeks ago when Senator John Edwards came to the LSE. We launched it slightly before publication. Those of you who came to that talk will remember that although John Edwards plainly hadn't read the book, he gave a robust and uplifting speech, which was a good launch occasion for it, I think. The New Egalitarianism is not a book just about the UK. It's about inequality across the industrial countries. The major theme of it, the reason why we call it the New Egalitarianism, is that I think most of us in the book argue, certainly myself and Patrick, who are the editors of the book, argue that the left must sustain its commitment to egalitarianism while, of course, defining what egalitarianism can and should mean in a modern society. But a new egalitarianism has to differ from, as it were, the old egalitarianism for two reasons. One being it has to give a great deal of attention to economic dynamism and job creation. Economic dynamism and job creation are no longer provided as centrally by the state as used to be the case, or many on the left thought to be the case, 20 or 30 years ago. Second, a new egalitarianism has to be compatible with the developed pluralism of our societies, which is the result of large-scale migration and other changes happening within the industrial countries. This book, as they say, would not have been possible without the assistance of Policy Network, which is a prominent think tank which funded a great deal of the seminars that contributed to it and in general has organized a good deal of the publication, although the publisher is also Polity Press. And I'd like to thank Matt Brown, Brannan Mira, and all the staff at Policy Network for all the work they put into this, because we had a whole series of seminars which led up to the final volume. Well, we've got a very distinguished panel to discuss some of the ideas in the book. Every single person sitting there is a contributor to the book, so let me introduce them briefly. They're all world famous, so they don't need long introductions. Nearest to me and the first speaker, Patrick Diamond, advisor to Tony Blair in No. 10 Downing Street, but taking, I think, 6 months off to work at the LSE and reflect on his experience at the centre of power. Next to him, Ed Miliband, until recently senior advisor to Gordon Brown, now a new MP, maybe at some time a future Chancellor of the Exchequer. And he did this amazing thing, Ed, at least I saw in the paper. He was at a party with Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, right close to him, and he was making both of them laugh simultaneously. Maybe he'll tell us what he said. Next along, well, one of the most celebrated figures in the LSE. You know, I was very, very happy to work with closely when I was here as director, Anne Power, professor of social policy at the LSE, famous for her work on housing. And then we've got someone we didn't expect, Robert Walker, who is one of, in my view, one of the core contributors to the book. So I'm very happy that he somehow came from outer space to be here this evening. He's, again, one of the best-known professors of social policy, sociology in the country, but his main contribution, something which I regard as very, very important, is the dynamics of poverty, the dynamics of inequality. We mustn't look at inequality simply by a static snapshot. We have to look at how patterns of inequality change over time, and over time, inequality looks very different from what happens if you do take a snapshot view of poverty. Finally, David Goodhart, the editor of Prospect magazine, and I must say he's done an amazing job with Prospect, and he was just telling me that it's coming up to its 10th anniversary, and so I'd like to congratulate him on that. So we're going to go in the sequence in which people are sitting. You'll be very pleased to hear that I'm not contributing to it, but just chairing it. So I first of all introduce Patrick Diamond.
Well, thanks very much, Tony, for those words of introduction. I think Tony's style of chairing is pretty much unique in the Western world, as he just exemplified by those words of introduction. And thanks also to Policy Network and to the LSE for hosting this discussion, and indeed some of the seminars which have made this publication possible. I'd like to begin by making two observations to introduce this evening's debate, touching on some of the defining themes outlined in this book that's been published, The New Egalitarianism. But before I do so, I want to say something briefly at the outset about progress in tackling poverty and inequality under this new Labour government since 1997, because I think that that's a very important focus for debate and puts in context where we need to go from here. Critics on the left since 1997 have argued and have persistently accused New Labour of lacking any serious strategy for tackling inequality. They've accused it of evading hard questions about redistribution and of refusing to address the gap between rich and poor. Now, a decade can seem like a very long time in social policy, but think back 10 years to 1995. The previous decade had brought a marked widening of inequalities with few parallels in British history, or indeed anywhere else in the Western world. And as my colleague Jeff Mulgan sets out in his contribution to the recent IPPR Second Commission on Social Justice, the trends of what occurred during the 1980s and 1990s were remarkable. But in that period up to 1995, poverty had fallen off the government's agenda altogether. And apart from occasional attacks on single mothers or the work shy, the government had very little to say then about poverty at all. The term social exclusion was not used on any side in politics. And within the elite, it was widely believed that inequality was perfectly compatible with high rates of economic growth and with social cohesion. Even mass unemployment for the Conservatives did not mean electoral annihilation, so long as the majority of voters were experiencing rising living standards. In any case, trickle-down from a booming economy would solve all of those problems, and a highly paid professional elite could enjoy the fruits of globalisation, while a poorly educated bottom tier would have to suffer greater insecurity in the new service economy. Now, of course, think tanks, researchers, many of them based here at the LSE, and activists sought to challenge this perspective, but in general, the prospect of rising inequality was taken as a given. If we think that 10 years on, the position now is simply unrecognisable, this government has committed itself to three ambitious goals. One, to abolish child poverty within 20 years. The second, to move towards full employment. And the third, to substantially narrow the gap between poor areas and the rest. Now, none of this will be easy to achieve, but the government can point to substantial and significant progress in each of these areas. It has set precise targets on everything from crime levels to mortality. A major expansion of redistribution, largely through tax credits, is now underway. And a sign of the change in the mood is that the Conservative opposition is now keen to proclaim its commitment to child poverty, however credibly we might regard such a commitment. And there are still powerful pressures driving greater inequality at both the very top and the bottom of the income range. But of surprise to many commentators is the fact that most of British society since 1997 has become both wealthier and more equal. So, for example, the number of individuals in households with incomes below 60% of the median has fallen from 13.9 million in 1996-97 to 12.4 million 6 years later. The number of pensioners living in poverty has fallen by a third. The number of children in relative poverty has fallen by a quarter during the same period. So the positive aspects of this story deserve to be celebrated. But that is not why we wrote this book. There are still major challenges ahead for any government which is seriously committed to a further assault on social inequality. And as the nature of the problems concerning poverty and inequality change, as the nature of politics changes, and indeed as the nature of the policy tools themselves change, we need to rethink and consider where we go next. And that was precisely the motivation for publishing this book. So, to the book itself. The first point to stress and to make clear is that, to state the obvious, the international trends which are highlighted in the book in relation to inequality do paint a highly complex picture, defying caricatures about variable rates of inequality in the European and American economies, and thereby demanding far greater policy sophistication from national governments. And in my view, at a time when we're debating the very purpose of the European Union and the sustainability of what is called the European social model, it provides a further reason why the conception of Europe as between or against America needs to be radically reconsidered, because it fuels complacency in Europe when the trends indicate a far more worrying picture. Second, strategies for reducing poverty and inequality are necessarily highly political. So any government that wants to tackle economic inequality has to develop a coherent political strategy. Now, in the mid-1990s, the OECD data suggests that rising inequality was strictly confined to the United States and the UK. But consistent with institutional factors that distinguish Anglo-Saxon economies from European societies, Anglo-Saxon countries allowed wages to be set within deregulated labour markets, creating jobs but not equity. In Europe, strong welfare states and regulated labour markets were said to contain the rise in inequalities that the UK, the US, Australia and New Zealand had witnessed in the recent period, pointing to the persistence of an employment equity trade-off. But the evidence indicates that this division between European and Anglo-Saxon economies no longer holds true. And indeed, the data in the book seems to show that a new tide of inequality is taking hold as a common structural feature of the advanced economies both in Europe and in America. And even in Nordic countries, the Netherlands and Germany, traditionally egalitarian societies, this seems to be greatly in evidence. So it's therefore mistaken for Europeans to be complacent about the trends in inequality and to dismiss rampant poverty and deprivation as an American epidemic. Esping Anderson's paper in the book points to some very alarming trends. All countries, with the exception of France and the Netherlands, experienced rising inequality of market incomes in the 1990s as deregulation, rising returns to skills, and an increase in the number of vulnerable single-parent households exerted their hold. The increase in earnings differentials in the early 1990s was also dramatic in the US and the UK, but very striking in the Netherlands and in Sweden, and grew significantly in Germany and in Italy. So across the OECD, the very top decile distanced itself from the rest as returns to skills were rising. The data also indicates that inequality of income and earnings differentials grew fastest in the most traditionally egalitarian societies, such as those Nordic countries. Now, we should not be fatalistic about these trends. The welfare state can stem the tide, and there are some positive trends, including the rising rate of female participation in the paid labour market. But job precariousness and insecurity are on the rise for those with few job-ready marketable skills in the advanced capitalist countries. So we should take seriously Esping Anderson's argument that the welfare state in Europe needs to refocus its efforts to become less transfer-heavy and more oriented to services such as childcare, lifelong education, and rehabilitation for the long-term unemployed. Moving on to my second observation, strategies for reducing poverty and inequality are, of course, intensely political. They're not merely about theory. And indeed, the purpose in politics is to shape the climate of ideas and to shift the axis, the gravity of political argument, in a direction favourable to you rather than to your opponents. So there is a fundamental political issue in engaging with these arguments, which is how to persuade the relatively affluent majority, many of whom feel hard-pressed to make ends meet, to spend money in areas they may rarely visit, on people they may not understand, leading lives that they may not understand. So it's easy to call for more redistribution, but we need to apply the same sophistication to the political analysis of redistribution as we do to the policies that might fight it. And I would argue that any significant redistribution has to meet four conditions. Firstly, it has to be fair. Second, it has to somehow fit the interests of the majority. Third, it has to be seen to be money well spent. And finally, it has to fit with everyday morality of need and desert. Now, the first of these is not hard to determine, since the majority of the British public clearly favour a fairer society. But the other three have turned out to be much harder than pioneers of past Labour governments appreciated. New Labour successfully recast much of the debate about economic inequality by addressing these issues directly, talking more about children than poverty as such, pointing out the indirect impact of poverty in terms of drug abuse, crime, and social incohesion, and showing the costs and waste of mass unemployment, realigning policy more around public views of need and desert, for example, through welfare-to-work policies. Taxpayers, and particularly swing voters, were much more willing to see their money redistributed to help needy children than to their parents, perhaps. justified too by the mounting weight of evidence of the effect of early years experiences from diet and parenting to cognitive development in schools on subsequent achievement. So any argument for further redistribution implied by the new egalitarianism needs to be as carefully thought through at a time when there may be more competition over resources and indeed anxieties over issues such as migration and asylum. As John Elster has written, our conceptions of justice are essentially moral conceptions and are therefore highly context-specific. Theoretical attempts to pin down a single consistent view always fail. And as John Rawls acknowledged towards the end of his life, this is the case for social justice. It has to be political rather than metaphysical, and it needs to be highly specific. Introducing a windfall tax on the privatised utilities to fund the New Deal programme, as we did in 1997, is one such example. So in summary, some short remarks about policy implications. New Labour has long favoured education as the best route to opportunity and poverty relief. It has regarded education as the motor of economic and social advance and as the key to electoral mobilisation. But the truth is, since 1945, education reform has not seriously diminished the importance of social origins in the determination of life chances. And in fact, the evidence suggests that less identifiable traits, such as social skills, cultural capital, and cognitive skills, have as much impact, especially in the knowledge economy, where the ability to manipulate and use information is so important. Now, these attributes are shaped very early on in the first months of a child's life. It's why parental status, not school, continues unabated in dictating a child's educational attainment, income, and occupational destination. So we need to give thought not just to how school and neighbourhood effects impact on children and their progress, but also the family milieu and how we support parents and families in the battle against poverty and inequality. Income redistribution is necessary, but not sufficient in the fight against poverty. So in conclusion, finally, we've described the book as setting out the case for a new egalitarianism. But the best of social policy, as the best of politics, is always a self-referential dialogue with the old. So as New Labour takes the next steps in countering inequality and tackling poverty during its third term, it should hold true to the words of a leading British social democratic theorist, Tony Crossland, who wrote this some 45 years ago. Socialism is basically about inequality, he said, more than a meritocratic society of equal opportunities and more than a simple redistribution of income. It has to mean a wider social equality, embracing the distribution of property, the education system, social class relations, power and privilege in industry, indeed all that was enshrined in the age-old dream of a classless society. And as Crossland believed, the moral purpose of social policy will never be finally settled or pinned down in simple premises. Instead, the case for social justice has to be constantly reframed and argued anew from first principles in every generation. That is a difficult thing to do. We've attempted at least to begin to do so in this book, and I hope that you enjoy the discussion that follows from the rest of this evening. Thank you very much.
Can I begin by thanking the organisers of this event and the LSE? I was thinking as I was preparing my remarks today that my dad, Ralph Miliband, spoke many times in this theatre. And in fact, actually, I was talking with my mum about this. He, I think, first probably came to this theatre in 1946 to come and hear Harold Lasky. Then a professor here, who was certainly also a public intellectual, and someone whose footsteps one would want to follow in. So it's a pleasure to be here. My argument is a product not so much of my time in the Treasury, but more my time at Harvard University when I took a sabbatical a couple of years ago. And it's more—it's not really a set of policy prescriptions. It's more a theoretical attempt to construct a framework in which or make a contribution to constructing a framework in which the centre-left can think about inequality. And I centre the essay in the book around four propositions, which I hope, as I say, make a contribution to the debate about how the left should think about inequality. The first proposition is that inequality has damaging effects on our society, and all of us who live within it. And that if we believe in solidarity, large gaps between in inequality or large amounts of inequality make it difficult to create a sense of community. Second, that we can recognise the importance of markets to our society, and that's something that New Labour has done since 1994. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you conclude that market outcomes are fair outcomes. And I'll explain what I mean by that in my remarks. Thirdly, that we should care both about inequalities of opportunity and about large inequalities of outcome. The two aren't in opposition, but are in fact complementary. A concern for inequality of opportunity and a concern about large inequalities of outcome. And the fourth proposition is that the inequality that we should care about goes far beyond income and wealth and needs to be thought of holistically and is about services and institutions and the broader fabric of people's lives, and I'll say what I mean by that. So let me talk briefly about these four propositions. The first is a fairly obvious statement, perhaps, that inequality can have bad effects. And these come into the category which I call a consequential category, the effects of vastly unequal outcomes on the society in which we live. Richard Wilkinson talks in the book about health inequality, about health, and the fact that societies are less healthy if they're more unequal. I want to concentrate on two aspects of this argument, though. One is about what I call self-respect, and secondly is about creating a sense of community. In a sense, getting people to worry about inequality is a hard sell for the left, because people might say, well, look, if you look over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, it's true that we've grown more unequal, but it's also true that the poor are richer than they were, more or less, you could argue, 20 or 30 years ago, certainly compared to 50 years ago. And obviously the answer to that is that everything we know suggests that people define their own self-worth in life relative to the community and the wealth of the community around them. Part of this is psychological, but part of it is real as well. If you take my constituency in Doncaster, if you don't have a car in my constituency, about two-thirds of people have a car, but if you don't have access to a car in my constituency today, your ability to lead a full life is severely restricted, more restricted than it would have been 40 or 50 years ago. That is, in a sense, an illustration of the fact that poverty and position can't be treated as absolute concepts, but have to be treated as relative concepts. So I think there's an argument from what I call self-respect to think that inequality damages our society. Secondly, fraternity and community. Now, in a sense, I think this matters for its own sake, because we value community, I think, in itself. And when you have significant gaps between rich and poor and people lead essentially separate lives, it is much harder to foster a sense of community. People, the bonds that people feel with each other are going to be much more limited. But it also matters for what you might call instrumental reasons. In his book, Exit Voice and Loyalty, Albert Hirschman talks about the fact that people who opt out of public institutions first are likely to be those most sensitive to the quality of the institutions, as well as those who can afford to. And hence, opting out is more likely to lead to a decline in the quality of the institutions themselves. This is quite apart from the effect of the effects on taxpayer support for things like schools and other collective institutions. The other thing I'd say in this area, under sort of proposition number one about the damaging effects of inequality, is I think it's incumbent upon those academics and others who think that inequality does have damaging effects to do more to sort of prove it, if you like. Because I actually think that we're sort of in the foothills of this debate about the implications of having the kind of unequal society that we have, and I've talked to people like Tony Atkinson about this. I just want to ask one question under this heading, though, which is, maybe what we care about is poverty, not inequality. Not the gap between the rich and the poor, but simply the position of the poor. Now, there's a not very popular political movement in political philosophy known as sufficientarianism, which stands for this. And a critic, not himself a sufficientarian, put it like this. Once we have brought someone to the good enough level, what happens above that level is not a concern of justice. It might be that an acceptable quality of life requires ready access to a functioning car, but it does not matter from the standpoint of justice that I drive a Chevy and you drive a Ferrari. This chap was an American, as you might have gathered. Now, what is attractive about sufficientarianism is I think it gets at our intuitions about what is morally troubling about the societies that we live in, which is the fact that some people are very badly off in what is generally a rich society. But defining what is enough requires a benchmark of some kind. Now, the argument from self-respect that I talked about earlier suggests that the level will be defined relative to the society in which we live. We set a child poverty target, for example, the Labour government, which was 60% of median income. Now, that is a poverty target, but in a sense it is a measure of inequality. It's a measure of the inequality between the poorest and the median. I think sufficientarianism does maybe offer us an ordering of our priorities. We're most concerned about the plight of those who are badly off in society, the position of the poor, as I say, relative to the average. And that's not to say we shouldn't care about the gap between the rich and poor, but given economic and political constraints, it may be more urgent to help the poorest relative to the median. So inequality matters for the reasons that I've set out. My second proposition is that market outcomes are not necessarily fair outcomes. Now what do I mean by this? It might be fairly obvious. I think this, it may be obvious to people in this room, but I think this is I think underlying the way in which inequality has fallen off the political agenda, this is very important. Because basically people think, if I worked hard for in life, I earned it. Now, to an extent, I agree with that. That's true. But if we really believe that inequality, that success or failure in the marketplace was entirely down to our own efforts, it will be harder to make the case that inequality was a problem. You could, from the point of view of citizenship, say we owe obligations to others, but it would, in a sense, play into the right-wing argument that any redistribution of market outcomes is somehow theft or expropriation. And the thing I would say is that, of course, effort and hard work play an important role in determining whether people succeed or not in the market. But other factors, which are evidently not within our control, also play a part. And I mentioned three in my essay, and I won't talk about them in detail. But first of all, unequal beginnings. People, fairly obvious point, people don't start from a fair, the same or a fair starting point, and that determines, to a large extent, your degree of success. Secondly, arbitrary circumstance. What determines whether people fail or succeed can often be unearned and accidental. And thirdly, and I want to pause on this point, what I call the argument from public goods. I was at a conference where Digby Jones, the Director General of the CBI, got up and said, I tell the people in this audience, if it weren't for the businesses of this country, there wouldn't be any schools. And a local authority leader got up and said, and I tell you, Digby, if it weren't for the schools of this country, there'd be no businesses. And in a sense, that plays into this point. Because even having ensured equal starting points and taking account of arbitrary circumstance, there are reasons for thinking that people's success is not simply due to their own private efforts. Bill Gates Sr., the father of the billionaire, wrote in his book, Wealth and Our Commonwealth, and I think nobody puts it better, actually, talking about America. Success is a product of having been born in this country, a place where education and research are subsidized, where there is an orderly market, where the private sector reaps enormous benefits from public investment. For someone to assert that he or she has grown wealthy in America without the benefit of substantial public investment is pure hubris. So for Gates, he believes, and I agree, that private success is often built on public institutions, and hence the individual owes something back to society. Now, even in the United States and Britain, where inequality is higher than among other countries, our tax and benefit systems redistribute resources so that inequality of final incomes is lower than that of original inequality in the marketplace. And implicitly, at least, I think there is an acceptance of this in our societies, although, mind you, I think this is why it's important, it's not necessarily spoken of in public debate, this idea of private success being built on public institutions and the contrast between accepting markets and not necessarily accepting market outcomes. The third point I want to make is about what sort of inequality we should believe in, and this point about outcomes and opportunities. It's pretty clear to me that both that you need to care about both. There was a big debate in the 1990s on the left in Britain about whether we should be focusing on inequality of opportunity. Now, that is correct, and I think there is a strong case for that. If you think about my constituency, lots and lots of people need educational opportunity to liberate themselves, need all kinds of opportunities, and simply redistributing incomes to them is not enough. But I think it's very hard to argue that large inequalities of outcome don't seriously affect your ability to achieve equality of opportunity. So, for example, most obviously, one generation's outcome will seriously affect the next generation's opportunity. And even within a generation, it's obviously the case that huge differences in outcome materially affect the opportunities that people have. So the person with a significant private income who, for the sake of argument, needs to upgrade their skills will have much more opportunity to do so than the person with no income to fall back on. So, and I think I agree with the quote that Patrick read out from Tony Crossland. The left, in my view, shouldn't simply seek meritocracy, the equal opportunity to be unequal, the same rewards preserved, but open to the talents, if you like. Because if we do that, we'll have a more procedurally fair pattern of inequality, but many of the arbitrary features of inequality and the consequential problems it creates will remain. The fourth point I want to make is that we need a broad conception of inequality. You might shorten this to say it's the tyranny of the Gini coefficient, which I'm taking aim at. The Gini coefficient measures inequality. And I sort of think just because that's the only thing we can measure, that's not the only thing we should focus on. To put it in practical terms, the Labour government has succeeded in stopping the Gini coefficient, which measures inequality, from rising. So I think if without the measures we'd taken to tackle poverty, it would have gone up to 36%. It remains at 34%. Now, I think that's important. But, again, you only need to visit poor communities around our country, and I know Anne will talk about this, to know that inequality is a much more pervasive phenomenon than simply being about income and wealth. Indeed, theoretically, if you think about Amartya Sen and his framework of capabilities, that puts egalitarianism in the context of giving people the real means to take control of their lives. So worrying about income inequality is important, but so should we be concerned about access to assets, to services, and I think what's something that's very important is institutions. The most important thing the Labour government has done in my constituency since 1997, or one of the most important things, is to build 4 Sure Start centres, because it significantly changes the fabric of the community. That somehow this is an ex-mining community where there are no pits left. And for the first time, there is a new focus for the community through these Sure Start centres. And that is that can't be grasped by the Gini coefficient. So those are my 4 propositions: that inequality matters, that the right-wing arguments which suggests that somehow worrying about inequality is wrong, fall away, that we should worry about outcomes and opportunities, but also that we need a broad conception. Now, this is all very well, what is essentially sort of theory, but the question is, how does this relate to practice? Now, Patrick talked about practice very well. I think this matters, actually, even though the debate in political philosophy is miles and miles and miles away from real politics. It matters. And I want to... He's becoming increasingly fashionable, but I want to use a quote from Tony Crossland as well to illustrate this, not from the future of socialism, but from an essay he wrote called Socialism Now, 30 years ago. He said, "A practicing politician in Britain, not cerebrating in the monastery cell, but living day by day in the thick of things, is not required to answer the stern examiner's question, how much equality ultimately? He has plenty of harsh, specific, and unmerited inequalities to combat in the next 10 years. And a decade is my time span, not an eternity." Now, I think Crossland was right in one sense, but he was wrong in another. The blueprint question, how much equality in the ideal society, is an important one for political theorists, but it's unreachable for politicians. But I don't think that means it doesn't matter. You see, I think Crossland is wrong about time span. Because the arguments that practicing politicians make today and the way they explain what they do will affect our society for decades to come in ways that matter, that should matter to us. When the 1945 Labour government won the arguments about the new welfare state settlement, it locked in a certain type of society for decades to come. Now, I think, and Patrick talked about the achievements of the new Labour government, I think another achievement is that we have shifted the debate about the importance of public investment in our society. And I think that has changed, and I think you see that in the debate within the Tory party today. I think that has changed the political landscape. I suppose what I'm also suggesting is that as well as policy, changing the discourse and changing the terms in which we discuss inequality will also help to change our society and will help us to secure a progressive legacy in the decades to come. Thank you very much.
I'm going to talk about where, what kind of places we're talking about when we talk about inequality and poverty. And I'm going to base what I say on three ideas of mine. One, that cities are built on neighbourhoods, and you can't make cities work if you don't make neighbourhoods work. Secondly, that in neighbourhoods there's a very strong link between the widest possible scale and the narrowest or most local scale. And thirdly, that we find it really easy to see social policy job by job, income by income, family by family, child by child, as the last two speakers have made clear. We find it very hard to see society place by place. I'm very much a place by place person, although obviously places are made up of people. And I just wanted to start with this dramatic picture that in 1960, 35% of the world was urban with a world population of 3 billion. By 2000, 50% of the world was urban. It might have been a bit less, might have been a bit more, with a population of 6 billion. And according to current trends, by 2030, the world population will be 8 billion and the urban population will be 5 billion. Virtually the whole of that urban growth, huge, another 2 billion people in cities over the next 30 years, will be in developing countries. But actually, it won't, because of what I'm going to explain, because there's a very strong link between that global pressure and what happens in urban neighbourhoods in this country, other European cities, and in America. And I'm going to run really quickly through a little bit of urban history, which you all probably know, but I'll still condense it as best I can. Modern industrial cities were a really sharp break from our pre-industrial past, where huge scales of consumption, production, and waste basically smashed up places that previously had been relatively sustainable on their small scales. And the big climate change agenda took off at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and it's on an upward trajectory of an incredibly alarmingly steep rate. At the same time, poverty became increasingly visibly concentrated in cities just because of the sheer packing of people, and whereas poverty previously and still in the developing world is very much a rural phenomenon, increasingly it's based in urban neighbourhoods. Certainly in the West, it's hard to find concentrated poverty anywhere except in cities. And that leads to intense decay of cities, because poor people basically can't maintain urban property and urban neighbourhoods, which in turn fuels suburbanisation, which in turn creates gaps in cities which new migrants constantly flow into to fill and to take up the jobs that are on offer. And so when we talk about global cities like London or Paris or New York or Tokyo, they're riding on the back of this long-run process of urban polarization, of better off people jumping the city and poorer people getting sucked in, and the huddled masses, as they've traditionally been called, getting concentrated in the least favored neighborhoods. Governments don't sit by while this is happening. They dream up, as the 1945 government did, utopian new housing models, very, very housing-driven, the shape of cities. So they come up with slum clearance plans, and in this country we demolished 2 million properties over a 50-year period in order to displace lots of these huddled masses into mass housing estates with their towers and their deserted conditions. And so sprawl became endemic in the developed urban world. And the problem with that is that urban environments are man-made and they don't regenerate themselves of their own internal motors. And the resources from government for regeneration are no way near the resources available from government to clear slums and build the new utopias. And the result is that in older neighborhoods, whether they're older estates or older inner city streets, environmental disorder and the legacy of earlier contamination, as Ed will soon, where's he gone? We'll soon discover.
He's watching you from the
back. Oh, right, hi. In his mining villages, where basically there are lots of places you can't build on and there are lots of places where people shouldn't really be living, because we've never paid back that legacy. All of that historic urban development has been made much, much more acute by the internationalization of the economy. First of all, people tend to live by income and area, and if better off people tend to jump out, the people who are left behind tend to be poorer. Secondly, as new migrants move in to fill the gaps, so the left behind indigenous population jostles with new migrants, and that can be a very uncomfortable place to be, as the riots in Burnley, Blackburn, Bradford and so on showed in the year 2000. Thirdly, the overall income level of the neighbourhoods that are in decay is too low to reinvest in property, and actually there are also many perverse incentives against that happening, like VAT on repair at 17.5%, whereas you can build new free. So all the better off people who go into new houses get their new houses VAT free, whereas all the poorer people who live in decayed neighbourhoods pay a 17.5% tax on any repair they do. Poorer neighbourhoods are mainly tenants, and so they've got very little incentive to invest anyway. And in this process, the mass housing estates that were the government's utopian solution become a liability. They're hard to manage, they're hard to live in, and they then experience a rapid exodus and decline, and new migrants move into them as well. And the consequence of all this turnover is a kind of social unravelling. Now, one of the things that we're doing in the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion at the LSE is tracking 12 representative areas in order to try and understand whether what Patrick and Ed are claiming for this government is really true. We began tracking these areas in 1997, and we're constantly revisiting them. I'll just tell you tiny, tiny bits about the areas. They're all in urban and industrial, with one exception, which is a seaside coastal town. And I'm afraid the fact that Spain builds 180,000 holiday homes a year has a very bad effect on places like Margate. Secondly, they're all in poverty clusters. They don't stand alone as a declining neighbourhood. They're part of lots of declining neighbourhoods. Thirdly, they're all transient and unstable to some extent, not entirely. And fourthly, there's a conflict between local desire for small-scale changes. So in Ed's Sure Start centres in Doncaster, I would bet my bottom dollar that the mothers want to go to Woolworths and buy plastic tractors and things like that. And the Sure Start government guidelines are heavy-duty, expensive wooden toys, which the mothers would see as a great extravagance. Just to give you some idea of the kind of conflicts you're up against when you try to transform neighbourhoods involving the grassroots, but at the same time driving from the quality agenda that the government rightly is trying to inject. So what do the people actually living in these kind of turbulent places that have experienced massive urbanisation, massive industrialisation, massive exodus of better off people, and now massive immigration of people from the four corners of the globe? Well, it's obvious to anybody who simply walks into these areas that conditions are very unequal. And one of the ways we've tried to discover a little bit more about this is by asking families. So we're interviewing, while we track the 12 areas, we're interviewing 200 families in four of the 12 areas. And they tell us everything there is to know about how it is to bring up children in these kind of areas. We feel that that's a very sensitive barometer of change, because parents with children are much more protective, they're on low incomes, they need to make life work. About half of them are new migrants, about half of them are lone parents, and the vast majority of them are on low incomes. So what we found is that these neighbourhoods are a microcosm of that very first chart I showed you. Huge demographic changes, really strong environmental degradation, and urban pressures concentrated there. So these areas experience more traffic, for example, than other areas, even though there are less car owners. That's just one little example. And so difficulties, as I've described in the bigger picture, are heavily concentrated at this very local level. And families particularly, but residents in general, say that they can only survive in these neighbourhoods if conditions are made more secure. But the very environmental degradation of the area actually makes it very difficult to give a signal of security to the people who walk those streets. And so people read in the physical signals of a neighbourhood that conditions are actually insecure, and therefore they should keep behind their doors until they can get out, which is one of the reasons why lots of the poorest neighbourhoods are very unpeopled. The other thing that we found is that people are from incredibly diverse backgrounds. Three of the four areas over the last 10 years have undergone a massive change in the population makeup of the areas. And that diverse background is maybe captured through two things. First of all, the tension that people feel about where they live. So one family in a northern area says, this area is just scruffy. It's like another country. It's like being in India. She's Indian herself. But then another mother says, it's okay most of the time. It makes you more flexible. It's good to have to be accommodating to so many different people. And there is a very high level of tolerance and solidarity, certainly among mothers and families, but only where people are pulled together. So things like Sure Start, schools, churches actually come out very well in the eyes of mothers, simply because they give people an anchor around which they get together. So anybody who tries to argue that community doesn't matter doesn't listen to mothers, and particularly doesn't listen to mothers in poor neighbourhoods. And I would argue that that is probably a very, very telling voice. So finally, how do you actually cope with all the pressures that poor neighbourhoods are under? Well, whether we like it or not, what people in the neighbourhoods cry out for is supervision. We did used to have lots of supervision, because we used to have park keepers, we used to have caretakers, we used to have people who swept the streets with brooms rather than came around in vans. We used to have policemen who walked rather than policemen who came around in vans. So supervision, visible street supervision, is crucial. And I think Ken Livingstone is inspirational in having decided that we don't just need more policemen, but we need more policemen who are visible on the streets. And there's an experiment now being mounted in London where the entire city is being divided up into neighbourhoods, and every neighbourhood will have its anchor policeman who cannot be pulled off to football duty or coronation anniversaries and things like that. And that is really, really important. And those people, therefore, have to be locally visible. And by the way, just as a matter of interest for those of you who don't understand about uniforms are extremely important, because then people are recognisable in a sea of faces from all over the world where nobody knows who anybody is. Thirdly, you have to base that kind of basic provision locally. So again, I don't want to make too much of Sure Start, but it really is a brilliant example of doing everything right. It wants to involve parents, it focuses on children, it's area-based, and it stays with the community even when they want plastic tractors. And that is just massively important. It's only the top people who criticise the plastic tractors. And the sort of final sort of point around that is that we have to see neighbourhoods within modern cities as a microcosm of global problems, because that's precisely what they are. I mean, we're always hearing these 150 languages spoken in the local school and all of that sort of thing. Well, it is actually played out that way on our streets. And so if these neighbourhoods, which are the building blocks of cities, are a microcosm of global problems, then surely they're also a nexus for tackling problems in the runaway world that Tony Giddens talked about And to me, that means that if we don't pay attention to our backyards, then our cities will fall apart under those huge pressures that I highlighted at the beginning.
Just before Robert starts, I should apologise for the heat in here, but we've now opened the doors and put the air conditioning on. I was worried that someone in the audience might die, or someone on the panel vis me might die, so I hope it's a bit cooler in here now than it was anyway.
As Tony said, my contribution, my chapter to the book, was concerned with inequality, poverty and exclusion, and specifically the dynamics of all three. My take on new egalitarianism, at least for this afternoon, is that we might want to think about a policy agenda that seeks to reduce the incidence and the concentration of poverty-causing events and to lessen the consequences for individuals and indeed for broader society of those risks. I want to begin by repeating the good news that Patrick began with, that since 1997, we have seen poverty rates in the UK fall. Since 2000-2001, we've probably seen inequality reduce. We've also got an agenda that talks about poverty, both on the international stage, but also locally here in terms of a poverty target for reducing, eradicating child poverty by 2019. We're also beginning to think about poverty in a new and more constructive way. Intellectuals have influenced the policy process, I think, in this regard. It's not long ago that we used to think about poverty as static. On the one hand, there were the poor, and on the other hand, there were the non-poor, and the two didn't seem to change places. And so our strategy was to count the people who were poor and to pay them as little as we could get away with as a society. We'd begun to realise that that's a rather simple, crude and cruel model, that thinking dynamically draws you to the obvious observation that spells of poverty begin and that they end, and therefore policy can be proactive. It can seek to prevent poverty and it can seek to bring spells of poverty to an early end. It's not long ago that we sought I've considered that permanent poverty was just the same as a single short spell, that recurrent poverty was no different from occasional poverty. What we now know is that they have different causes, a different ideology. We also know they have significantly different consequences, both for individuals and for societies and communities in which they occur. We also know that there's dynamics to do with neighbourhoods, that it's not the poor who live in poor neighbourhoods all the time, that people enter those neighbourhoods and leave those neighbourhoods, leaving behind those who want to remain or can't find a way to get out. We also know, by thinking dynamically, that far more people experience spells of poverty than one might think. In the decade to 2000, 52% of British citizens and their children experienced a year of income that was less than the poverty level. So in other words, policies that are directed to the minority, the poor, are actually benefiting directly the majority. Therefore, a moral campaign to challenge, to eradicate poverty has a rather good political expediency, because it appeals to the majority of the population, since the majority have experienced spells of poverty. Focusing then on triggers is where I think we should begin to address our attention. We could tackle bringing spells of poverty to an early end. And in many ways, that's what Labour has done, and comparatively successfully, since it was elected in 1997. What is New Deal and all that sweep of policies? Certainly the focus of people on working age has been to shorten spells of poverty. But if you look at the science, if you look at the dynamics, it's very clear that it would be much more successful to prevent people becoming poor in the first place than once they're poor to try and eradicate their poverty. The reason could be moral, but it's also rather pragmatic once again. Because what you find is that somebody who has experienced a spell of poverty is far more likely to go on and experience one more spell, two more spells, three more spells. That somebody who's had a short spell, almost by definition, because you have to have a short spell before you can have a long one, has a much higher probability of ending up in long-term poverty. And the consequences of long-term poverty are much greater. So the focus, science would suggest, is to stop people becoming poor in the first place. And that's why we want to focus on those events in society which seem to trigger spells of poverty. What are those triggers? What are those events? Well, they're enormously varied. But what we know is that the distribution of those events is very unequal. The chances of you being poor tomorrow is far less than the chances of a collection of people in the comprehensive school down the road. Risk is unequally distributed. Much more amazingly, though, the impact of a risk occurring and the chances that that event will lead to poverty is even more unequally distributed than the chance of the event occurring in the first place. So the focus is on triggers. Tony said when I wrote my paper, "So what? So what?" he said. "Think what we should do about it. I have not got an agenda of solutions. No way. I've begun, however, to scratch my head and think, what can we make this science do in order to improve the society in which we live?" And it seems to me that one can think at three sorts of levels. I'll begin at the individual level, because that's where I argue policy is at the moment. We emphasise individual responsibility and individual action in the nature of our social contract between the state and the voter. There is sense in doing that. In the modern society in which we live, we all have to design and develop our own life project. Gone is the day when you were born and the world happened. We have to take choices. We can no longer rely on what our parents tell us. We have to decide who to get married. We have to decide what job we take. We have to decide what insurance policies we will take out. That's why the service sector exists for the middle class, to help them take those decisions. But that service sector is not universally available to those who are poor. Perhaps if one focuses on individual responsibility and puts in place not just the personal advisor whose job it is to get you into work, but somebody with appropriate skills to help you think about your career and your future, maybe there's a role to play there. But that's only part of the story. It seems to me that we have to work together and think strategically and collectively, to take strategic and collective action, to lessen risk and to lessen the consequences of risk. A couple of examples. Firstly, we clearly have to focus on the institutions that create risk. The labour market is obvious, is it not? And indeed, for working age people, it's the labour market that generates most of the income. And we've done a lot of work on minimum wage. Well, it's creeping up. We've got tax credits in place. We are focusing on resources within the labour market. But we've done not that much in relation to employers, although they tell us the red tape is strangling them. We need to think about perhaps the activities, the responsibilities, and indeed the needs of employers. We might be thinking about sector-wide skill development programmes, which enable people to build careers and those careers to service the needs of industry. One of the real big problems is that once you get somebody back into work, that's dead easy. Keeping them there beyond 13 weeks, the definition of sustained employment that our current government uses, 13 weeks is hardly secure employment. The scope for peripatetic human resource management for small employers. Small employers are major employers in terms of the numbers. But what happens when things go wrong? What happens in a personnel crisis? What happens in terms of an attempt to implement equal opportunities or diversity plans within small employers? They scratch their heads. They walk away. I know, because I was one. Okay, if we are trying to influence the institutions that create risk, I think, too, we should seek to reduce the impact of those risks. That was the sort of thing that Esping Anderson was saying and was referred to earlier in terms of thinking about the services that one might put in place. Social insurance we've typically thought about in terms of cash transfers. Can we not think about it much more creatively in terms of service provision? Social insurance to deal with the career shifts and changes that we necessarily make, the fundamental retraining that all of us have to go through, which is pretty easy when you're at LSE, is rather difficult, once again, when you're in a labour market working 60 hours a week for very low pay. What about the loss of the second earner? That's a major cause of poverty in Britain. What about relationship breakdown, the biggest risk in terms of causing poverty? What about care needs of older people? Can we think more creatively, therefore, in terms of the progressive social insurance that one might want to advocate? In sum, dynamics makes you think again. It makes you think harder, and it's harder to think. But what I suggest is that perhaps we should be considering a comprehensive risk reduction strategy that's likely to entail policies which have to do with the workings of the institutions that create the risks in the first place. Perhaps provide access to continuing advice and support in individuals who are planning and pursuing their life projects, you and I and everyone, and novel forms of collective insurance to meet the newly emerging risks that are a key characteristic of the globalised economy in which we live.
Still awake and not too hot. I'm rather the odd one out in this book, although Tony said I wasn't to say that, in that my paper is not primarily about equality and inequality, although I think it probably does overlap somewhat with Anne Powers. I guess I'm really talking about something that comes prior to that debate, which is a necessary condition of that debate, and that is the existence of a strong sense of national citizenship and national membership in a society as a condition of generous welfare states and extensive redistribution. I think this matters for two reasons, really. One is a defensive political reason for the left. Unless the left has convincing answers to this whole new cluster of policy issues we call the security and identity issues, unless the left has some kind of answer to those issues, which have become of much greater salience to voters in the last few years, then the left will simply not be in power and none of these ideas will ever have a chance of being implemented. But I think there is another, even if the left is in power, it's important for politics to help to foster a strong sense of national membership. Otherwise, in the long term, people's willingness to pay for a generous welfare state will, I think, decline. I got interested in these issues partly as a result of writing an essay in Prospect called Too Diverse? About the possible conflict between solidarity and diversity in developed societies. That article caused a ripple or two of interest. And my sort of penance, in a way, for writing was that afterwards I got invited to dozens and dozens of seminars and conferences on race and immigration and asylum. And it was a learning process for me. This was not a wasn't a specialist in these areas, and I'm still not. But I did come to see what I thought was a kind of political inconsistency, particularly on the left, which tends to be the main voice at such conferences. And the inconsistency is this, that the left essentially thinks in group terms when it comes to sociology and economics. But when it comes to issues of national culture, national community, the left suddenly goes all Thatcherite. It suddenly sees society as more or less a random collection of individuals, and it follows therefore from that that it doesn't really matter who becomes a new citizen. Indeed, it may be rather reactionary and even racist to worry too much about who does become a new citizen. And I think that that inconsistency is not really affordable any longer. We do have to think about collective identities, collective national identities, particularly with the decline of other forms of collective identity, most notably class. There is such a thing as society. It's just that everywhere and always it is a specific, particular national society. And I think that doesn't mean to say the left has to go all nationalist, but I think it does mean that the idea of progressive nationalism is not an oxymoron, and indeed is the best framework within which to prevent rampant individualism and social and ethnic balkanization. Now, obviously, as we all know, most Western societies over the last 50 years have gone through a process of what one might call, it's rather an ugly concept, but dehomogenization. That's been a result of all sorts of factors, affluence itself probably the single most important, huge increase in value and lifestyle diversity, particularly associated with the 1960s, the ethnic diversity that has come with increased immigration, the greater physical mobility of all citizens, the breakdown of extended families, the breakdown in continuity, the kinds of things that Anne Power was talking about, the breakdown in continuity and stability and patterns of reciprocity in some local communities. Now, many of those things, not the latter particularly, but many of those things obviously represent a huge and welcome increase in freedom. But I think those things also do, for those people that worry about redistribution and welfare states, they do potentially have a darker side too. The welfare state, after all, was established at a time of much greater homogeneity of all kinds, when people's life experiences were much more similar than they are today. And I think the $64,000 question is, can we hold on to the welfare state and redistribution, and indeed the form of our mass democracy, as we become more diverse and individualistic and experience greater social distance? Now, I mean, I think, being an optimist, obviously, I think the answer is yes. But politics has a very important role to play here. It must reinforce what we still have in common. How can it do that? Well, obviously, all sorts of ways. But I think a clearer spelling out of the citizenship contract is certainly one whole cluster of thinking and policy. I don't mean here, I mean, this whole debate, I think, is often characterized in terms of the issue of shared values. I mean, I think we're simply too heterogeneous, too diverse now for concentration on values to be very helpful. I mean, I do think those admittedly quite small, but I think important policy issues that are associated with the name of David Blunkett, citizenship in schools, ceremonies for new citizens, and so on, I think are a small but useful step. This is also partly about, in Jürgen Habermas's famous phrase, constitutional patriotism, accepting the rules of the political game, accepting legitimate political authority. It's partly about reinforcing shared norms on freedom of speech, women's rights, and so on. It's also partly about the reinforcement of the institutions that still bind us together, whether it's the NHS, the BBC, the Sure Start programme that Anne Power was talking about, the post office. These are very important institutions still. think more controversially, the good society does at some level require some sort of commitment of citizen to citizen, even a kind of emotional commitment, at least from as many citizens as possible. Someone who's recently written about this is Bhikkhu Parekh. And let me just quickly read you something that he said about this idea of a kind of emotional commitment. Societies are not held together by common interest and justice alone. If they were, the sacrifices their members make for each other, including sharing resources and giving up their lives in wars and national emergencies, would be quite inexplicable. They need emotional bonding. That, in turn, springs from a common sense of belonging, from the recognition of each other as members of a single community. And that requires a broadly shared sense of national identity. That is a sense of who they are, what binds them together, and what makes them members of this community rather than some other. I think the second area of policy focus is essentially measures of citizenship reassurance. This is sometimes called majority reassurance, but I think it should also be called minority reassurance in a way. It's about reassuring people their national citizenship and the entitlements associated with it remain privileged and protected, and others are not free-riding in significant numbers. Now, a lot of people, of course, think that there isn't very much free-riding, and that is to some extent true, but that doesn't mean to say that this is a problem invented by the Daily Mail. It does seem to be the case that there is a huge sensitivity, particularly in developed welfare states, particularly in welfare states where people on lower incomes pay more of their income in tax than people on higher incomes. There's an acute sensitivity to welfare free riding, that the Daily Mail may be able to shape the form of the anxiety people have, but it does seem to be something to do with the opacity of our society. Prospect magazine did an opinion poll with Murray a year or so ago, in which we asked people whether they thought other people were getting an unfair advantage over them in public services and welfare spending. And a rather depressingly large 45% of people said they did think that. And when they were then asked who they thought was getting one over on them, as it were, almost everybody cited asylum seekers. And there the Daily Mail probably will have played a small role. But one of the actually reassuring things about the poll too was how virtually nobody mentioned the established ethnic minorities of Britain. Asylum seekers were mentioned, old people were mentioned, academics I think were mentioned. In some ways, there was a pessimistic but also an optimistic aspect to it, I think, that the them does become the us over time. Anyway, I do think, you know, we have to take this whole issue of sensitivity to free riding very seriously, and that is why I, for one anyway, support at least the principle behind ID card legislation. It is why it is important to have properly managed migration in place. I know it's a great deal easier said than done. And all these things are particularly important now because it's actually getting harder to deal with these problems now, partly because of the way the welfare state itself is changing. That, you know, even 20 years ago, substantial parts of the welfare state were still insurance-based. And now that almost all of it is essentially paid for out of general taxation, common pool-based. In a common pool system, you need to have greater trust in your fellow citizens, essentially. And this is happening at a time when trust is declining, not rising. So we have to worry about that. Finally, I think we need to... I think to a lot of people, the idea of a progressive nationalism is an oxymoron. But I think we do need to persuade people otherwise and to renew the symbols and rhetoric of a progressive, post-ethnic British nationalism. There are all sorts of opportunities for that, partly because Britishness has remained, in a way, such a weak phenomenon and is getting weaker. We don't have a British National Day. We don't have a State of the Nation address and all sorts of things like that, which would be relatively easy to implement. I think we need to create a new myth of Britishness, in a way. And although I think Gordon Brown has said some useful and interesting things in this area, I think he's rummaging around too much in the past, looking at and also talking too much about rather sort of general principles and values that other countries, such as tolerance and liberty, that other countries can claim an equal hold on. So I think we should look to the future and try and establish, as I say, a new myth of Britishness as a means of countering the social fragmentation and social distance that is growing all around us. And if we don't do that, if we don't create a proper sense of we're all in this together, then I think the trends suggest that in 30 to 40 years' time we'll wake up and we'll find we have become like the United States of America. Thank you.
Well, we've got a few minutes for discussion for those that stay anyway. There are roving mics upstairs and downstairs. Could I ask anyone who asks a question just to ask one question? And also, since there isn't much time, to ask it of a particular panelist rather than generically to the panel. Someone who's very keen to ask a question back there.
George Jones,
familiar face in
XLSE. Would the new egalitarians on the platform tell us what role local government has in their future model? We've heard about the importance of nationalism and we've heard about something called community. But between that, as surely institutions related to cities, counties, towns and villages, places that people still identify with. And if there's been one major failing of this Labour government, it is centralisation, which has sucked the vitality out of local political institutions that could be tackling many of the problems that you have so well described. Really, are you so gripped by the menace of the postcode lottery that egalitarians, the new egalitarians, want uniformity imposed from the centre on supine communities?
Well, new egalitarians also want to give quite a few people a chance to contribute, so it'd be good to ask short questions if people would. I'm going to ask Anne Power to respond specifically to this question.
Okay. Local authorities don't have a fantastic track record. They sorted out lots of our original urban problems by laying pavements, creating sewers, cleaning up water supplies, building swimming baths, schools, and so on. And one of the things I argue at the end of my chapter is that precisely the way we're going to make cities work better, more equally, and integrate neighbourhoods more is by rediscovering that kind of cause approach from local authorities to their areas. And certainly all our evidence would support there being no replacement to local authorities. On the other hand, the idea that local authorities can actually deliver as elected landlords well to their tenants has been belied by 100 years of experience. And the idea that local authorities are the only bodies that cities need in order to control and orchestrate what happens has also been belied. So somehow what we haven't yet found is enough of a mix between local authorities as the overarching bodies that at the end of the day people will turn to, will choose, and will put their trust in, and many, many, many much more local delivery bodies. It is a tricky balance. It simply is not true, although I would criticise the government for some of the measures it's taken, that the government has only centralised, because local authorities have been given bigger budgets, they've been given more control over some things. Other things they've lost control over, and it's good that they have. For example, housing is now a much more broken up responsibility, and I would argue that's been an advance. Schools are much more localised, and certainly our parents report that it's one of the places where they feel they have influence, whereas before they didn't. So I think it's a much more mixed picture. And I don't think we can go back to this idea that local authorities sorted everything out in the Halcyon days of Joseph Chamberlain in Birmingham, and we can bring that back. On the other hand, we do need local authorities. We can't escape from that. And the Mayor of London, by the way, has done very well. And that's because the government created a devolved government for London with some ability to do things.
Ed Miliband's a bit more of an old leftist than he pretends. He suggests I take a group of questions collectively, which I will now therefore do, and ask the panellists to keep a log of them and then respond to at least some of them. We've got someone upstairs who wants to ask a question.
Well, I was going to address my question to Mr. Patrick Diamond. I want to know if I've got the distinction between the old egalitarianism and the new egalitarianism correct. The old egalitarianism was based on the idea that all citizens ultimately had an equal right of ownership over the assets of their society. It was based on the notion that concentrations of wealth were to be regarded as a kind of public trust. The wealthy person or institution didn't own the wealth, they owned an interest in that wealth, which was in a sense nationally owned. Because it was nationally owned, the citizenry could instruct the institutions of the state, say government, to sequestrate the assets of those concentrations of wealth or the income, and to make those assets or income available to disadvantaged groups in society. And they could do that because the citizenry had a better claim to own that wealth than those notionally controllable. In the new egalitarianism, we accept that there are different orders or categories of citizens with fundamentally different rights of ownership over the assets of our society. And we seek, using public policy interventions, to mitigate the worst consequences of that maldistribution of ownership. Now, can I just ask, have I got that distinction correct? And to supplement it, what was wrong with the old egalitarianism?
Good job of taking groups.
Can we have another question from down here? Any lady questioner in the audience? I can't see one. Maybe I'll just take a gentleman down here. This is an academic institution, but if you could bear to ask a short question, it would be most welcome.
Okay, my question's very short. I wanted to direct it to David Goodhart. I was wondering, David seemed to portray the willingness of a society to redistribute its wealth and create greater egalitarianism as dependent on the national identity, the strength of national identity within that society. I was wondering how that could be consistent with greater international funding to address poverty relief on a global scale, and whether that's counter to the very notion of international poverty relief. Thank you.
No, it's okay. Yeah, okay, go first then. Short question.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Anne Power whether you'd found any evidence that greater diversity is leading to a lesser commitment to the welfare state in this country, as David Goodhart assessed.
Excellent.
This question is directed primarily to the last speaker in light of his closing comparison with America. What do you think? Great progress made in the United States by the most socially oppressed and economically deprived group, the group most deprived of opportunity, the Native American Indians, was a result of the phenomenon of Indian gambling, to a legal interpretation, has converted much of that group into some of the wealthiest people within the United States, and to a fair degree, they're sharing the wealth with fellow tribesmen. Other tribes without casinos remain very oppressed. Would you comment on the phenomenon of American Indian gambling and the progress it's made in the context of your remarks?
Thank you. Please, up the top there. Great. Well, either person.
Very short question. Is it not true that the biggest single source of inequality is the existence of unpaid caring responsibilities, both at a household and at an individual level, because there is intra-household inequality as well as inter-household inequality? And I don't mind which of you, but none of you mentioned this. the breakdown of relationships seems to me to be secondary to the existence of unpaid caring responsibilities.
Thank you. Did you want to ask a question up there as well?
To the last speaker, you're talking about, you know, you said in the end, we're all in this together, all you Brits, talking about reinventing British progressive nationalism. Now, to me, I'm not British, and yes, I would be very keen on solving the problems brought ahead by Miss Thatcher, because of mass privatization and so on during the 80s, and I think that Britain probably has not recovered yet, although I'm not an expert on the matter. And what I'm wondering is, it sounds like you are restricting the problem of poverty and general inequality, not just wealth and income, but opportunities as well. It sounds like you're confining this problem to our beloved British Isles and island nation, when in reality, the duty of a Labour government, well, when in Britain, should of course be to primarily fight the condition of the poorer British working class and unprotected layers, but it should also be to actively educate the entire British population, perhaps beginning with its working class, that yes, we're all in this together, but we're all in this together whether we be American, whether we be Chinese, whether we be from Zimbabwe or France or Kathmandu, I don't care, but we're all in this together. And this is, I mean, I don't expect you to answer this, but this is the quibble that I have with reformists. You reformists, you try to give capitalism a human face. But what we have to do is transcending capitalism, because we've tried for 50 years to solve the problems of inequality within the frame of capitalism, and by God, it hasn't worked. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think I only have time for one more question, maybe, since you were fairly persistent.
Thanks. My question's to Patrick and Ed. It's really a question to ask when you expect the government to have delivered social justice, not just for children, because obviously we all support the commitment to end child poverty by 2020 in the UK, but to deliver social justice for all the citizens of this country.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is just ask the panel to respond to one main question each, and just work our way along, and maybe just talk for 2 or 3 minutes each panelist, because there isn't a lot of time left, really. So I'll start with you, David.
Start with me. Well, I'm very much in favour of Indian gambling. I've always been a very strong supporter of it. What I meant, obviously, by reference to the United States, was the fact that you have, compared to most of Europe, you have a very thin welfare state and a very much more unequal society, even than Britain. On the gentleman down here, it's a good point. I mean, one doesn't want to get carried away with even progressive nationalism, but I do think it's entirely consistent with being a good European and a good internationalist. But we have to acknowledge certain realities about the modern state. We believe in equal citizenship, and we believe in sharing substantial parts of our resources with our fellow national citizens, not with everybody else in the world. I mean, you just have to look at the comparison between what we spend every year on the National Health Service and on foreign aid. You know, thankfully, we're increasing the proportion we spend on foreign aid, but we still spend something like 25 to 30 times more on the NHS than we spend on foreign aid. Citizenship, and this is why I think it's appropriate to continue to use, I know it gives lots of people heebie-jeebies, but we've got to use the word national and nationalism, because it is partially an exclusive thing. It is an exclusive thing. Not completely. It is consistent with being generous in foreign aid, being relatively open to migration still. But for those things to work and for that generosity to be sustained, all governments have to recognise their primary duty is to their existing citizens, and indeed that those existing citizens' primary concern beyond their own families is to their fellow citizens, national citizens.
The cynic might suggest that aiming at children and social justice for children is actually a device for tackling social justice for adults. Children happen to be cuddly and nice, and there's no questions about deserving and undeserving. Having said that, the question, in a sense, focuses on economy, on money. and I'm not sure that we're necessarily delivering social justice to children. I listen hard to hear the voice of children and don't hear it very loud. The question about global capitalism and everything and the sins of capitalism and its achievements. The achievements are actually, unfortunately, quite many. Just look around this room. Just look at your future careers. Look at the poor, poverty-stricken academics. There's a sense in which capitalism, in a sense, works. But if you think about the last century and reflect on the role that the welfare state has played in terms of a process of governance, an interaction of body politic with a capitalist system, it seems to me that your question is crucially important because it draws our attention to the wider world. I can't see the welfare state of the 21st century being nationalistically based. It seems to me we have to think about organs of global governance, and I think that's the real challenge for the future.
Okay, really, really quickly. First of all, on this question of encountering less commitment to the welfare state through greater diversity, it's really a kind of conflicting picture. So where there's direct competition, like access to housing or school places, there's a huge, huge amount of tension, and people articulate it unbelievably clearly. On the other hand, families only survive with social contact. And if you're in a diverse neighbourhood, then the community that you can create in that diverse neighbourhood is just as important as the community that you can create in a more stable and more homogeneous neighbourhood. There's also this issue that one of the results of government hyperaction targeting neighbourhoods, and Sure Start is only one example, but all sorts of childcare is another, school assistance is another, medical assistance is another, is the creation of lots and lots of jobs for women, part-time, local, what Tim Brighouse has called paraprofessional jobs. And those go across the board, white, black, brown, every kind of parent suddenly gets access. So the employment rates of our parents have hugely shot up in the last 5 years, and that is very, very important in actually bringing people together. And there's no resistance as far as I know. I never heard anybody say, it's not fair, black people are getting the jobs. Mothers do not talk like that. Following on from that, mothers need to get together with other mothers, and they really don't seem to care whether what nationality they belong to. And in fact, that's where the tolerance really comes out. They think it's better, even the ones who are quite prejudiced in the way they articulate the pressure on them, actually think it's better for their children to be mixing with children from different backgrounds. And one spectacular case we have of a cross-generational melding is where a black family is horribly harassed, I mean brutally harassed, and where the person who most defends that family and actually helps them solve the problem is an elderly white tenant who sees it all and agrees to give evidence. On the unpaid caring responsibility, there is this other thing which one of our LSE professors has written extensively about called happiness, and it is very, very important to remember that caring is not just a burden, caring is a huge reward, and people do think of it as something they should do unpaid. There's a huge fuss in lots of low-income areas about whether grandmothers should be paid for helping care for their grandchildren. That's an unresolved issue. It's a very divisive issue. But the vast majority of the mothers we talk to actually want to care for their children and want to do a lot of the social things they do unpaid. Finally, on the global issue, Partha Dasgupta wrote an amazing lecture called Are We Consuming Too Much? Basically, my answer to David Goodhart's logic would be that rich countries ride on the back of 200 years of using the resources of the world, and they will spend the next 200 years trying to equalize that. They will be given no choice. And so this idea that we have to contract what we do and we have to converge with poorer countries will actually catch up with us simply by virtue of the depletion of our environmental resources. I really am persuaded of that. And all the international scientists basically accept that logic.
Thank you. If I can make just a brief comment, I think the question about American Indians is more interesting than David actually seemed to imply, because Native Americans were the most dispossessed group in American society. They were thought to be culturally totally inert. They had very high levels of drunkenness. And yet out of that, you can get this amazing entrepreneurial spirit, which shows you that poorer people, no matter what happens to them, have extraordinary capacities which are often not capable to be realised, and that's one of the points I think of Robert's analysis dynamics of poverty?
First thing to say is I thought my dad would agree with the gentleman upstairs who asked his question about the capitalist system. I want to briefly touch on the questions to David and then come to the question that was asked of us. I think David's essay and his original essay is important because I think it puts the question of solidarity on the agenda, which is not something that is talked about that much. Now, I think that he, implicit in his argument, he overestimates the amount of domestic solidarity that there is. In your argument, there's a sort of sense that somehow rich people in Britain would be very happy to redistribute to the poor as long as they're British poor. And I think that's sort of heroic, really. I'm not necessarily convinced that the sort of reason why there isn't more support for redistribution is the presence of asylum seekers, etc. They are, it's true that they are blamed by people and there's a lot of criticism of them, but I'm not necessarily convinced of that. Another way of answering the question that was asked is to ask, why is it that this week we are wearing, I'm not wearing one, Make Poverty History wristbands and not wearing Make Domestic Poverty History wristbands? Now, that is partly for obvious reasons that African poverty and third world poverty is clear, extreme. I think it's partly because it's distant, which actually, in a funny way, helps the cause. It's backed by celebrity. And maybe the question, the task for us, is to get people to wear wristbands which say Make Domestic Poverty History or Make, Inequality History in a domestic context. How do we do that? I think that we've made progress in the last 8 years. I think it was never going to be a big bang, this Labour government, in terms of its assault on poverty. I think the task is to entrench your values and a set of social democratic values and a set of sort of altruistic values into your society in a way that the Swedish Social Democrats have sort of done. And over time, you will find that we become a different sort of society. I think if we had another 8 years of what we've had in the last 8 years, Britain would look quite different in 8 years' time. That's not to say I defend everything the government has done or say that we've necessarily done enough. But I think the answer to your question is, when will we achieve social justice? I can't give you a precise date. But I think if we hold to the course that we've set out, then I think we can transform the country. And I'm not as pessimistic as a lot of people are.
Say a couple of very brief words in response to those questions. I have to say the question that was specifically directed towards me, I haven't thought about some of those issues since I attended a Socialist Workers' Party meeting at Cambridge University in about 1993, but perhaps I should go back and think about those issues again. I mean, I have to say that within the context of the new and old egalitarianism, we haven't specifically considered the problem that you allude to. But let me just say, I mean, the reason why we've distinguished old from new egalitarianism is the sense in which the kind of old redistributive social democracy of the 50s and 60s, which did many good and important things at that time, was subject to a very severe assault by the new right in the 1970s and the 1980s. So the reason why we've developed this concept of the new egalitarianism is not to abandon the notion of equality or the principle that citizens should be more equal, both economically, socially, and indeed culturally, but for the very reason that we need to recover, in a sense, what's important about that equality and win the political case for it again. And to follow up what Ed said, I mean, it seems to me that we do have an enormous opportunity. I mean, many people are frustrated by the pace of change in respect of inequality and poverty and the trends over recent years, but the fact is the government has made progress, not as much as some people would have liked, but it has made a significant improvement. And it seems to me that the question really now is partly a policy one. We've heard this evening some excellent characterizations of what those policy frameworks might be in terms of the issues that Robert raises about life course dynamics, the issues which Anne raises about cities, and indeed issues which David raises about national citizenship. But it seems to me that the issue now is as much as a policy formulation one, to do with political strategy, to do with how we couch the arguments. And in the end, if you want, as the gentleman said, to reach some kind of defined endpoint in respect of achieving a socially just society, technical solutions are, of course, part of the answer, but in the end, you will only do it if you fundamentally change the culture. And I think we've gone some way to doing that, but we have some way to go. And as I said in my brief presentation, in order to do that, we have to consider how we articulate our arguments to the population. And I think we on the left, just finally, probably do stand accused of in the past having simply made the case for redistribution without really making it in terms of arguments that citizens could understand about why that redistribution was just and about why it was necessary. And I think in the period ahead, as I say, as this generation goes on to make the case for social justice in the way that previous generations have made, those are precisely the issues that I think we have to consider.
Can I just make a few thanks before we finally pick up? Thanks to the audience for coming and for staying. Thanks to the LSE for hosting the event. Thanks to Polity Press and all the people who work at Polity Press, especially Emma Longstorff, David Held, for all the work they put into the book. And finally, thanks to the panel. I thought all their contributions were really good, and so maybe the book is a bit better than I actually thought it was.